Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many parents despair when their well-behaved, good-natured children reach adolescence and become risk-takers, troublemakers, and almost unrecognizable. It would appear to be a state that is unnatural and certainly a dysfunctional phase typical only of Homo sapiens, but Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers beg to disagree. In their latest book, Wild Hood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adult in Humans and Other Animals, they claim this phase is not only natural, but useful and typical of many species. The book is published by Scribner. We're very pleased to welcome them to our show now. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Did the both of you have typical adolescences, or shouldn't I ask that question? Barbara?
Yeah, I don't know what a typical adolescence is, but what I do know, having spent the last 5 years with Catherine researching the lives of wild animal adolescents, is that what I went through between the ages of, let's say, 10 and 24 has a lot in common with what wild penguins, hyenas, whales, and wolves go through after puberty themselves.
And Catherine, you as well, or do you have other animals?
I would say the same thing, that what we realized after diving deeply into this topic for 5 years is that although it may seem like the, you know, ruining the family photo with an eye roll, an adolescent eye roll, or the kind of risk-taking that we see teens doing in humorous and scary ways, that might all seem uniquely human, but it actually, every creature on Earth goes through four main things on their path to adulthood, and I guess I did too.
Is it fair to say that this is part of natural development, a necessary break from parental guidance?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we looked really broadly. The methods that we used were very specific in that we didn't want to be anthropomorphizing. In other words, we didn't want to be projecting human characteristics onto animals in a way that was not scientifically justifiable. But we were also looking for common, universal even experiences. And what we found was that from fish all the way through other mammals, there are four tests, really four high-stakes tests that shape the destiny of every adolescent. And even though the specifics are different, all adolescents have to learn to stay safe. That is, they learn to have to keep themselves safe when they're not directly being protected by parents. They need to learn how to socialize and find a place for themselves in a group, and remember that other animals are social animals, and that's incredibly important to their survival and long-term success as animals. They need to learn how to communicate sexually. So it's sometimes called courtship behavior, but it can take a long time, and it's pretty hard. And finally, if an animal is going to really be a successful and independent adult, he or she needs to learn how to find their own food and take care of themselves, be self-reliant.
Do you think many parents of adolescents will find comfort in this book, at least get relief from a sense of guilt, the idea that if they had been better parents, their children wouldn't be acting in this way?
That's so interesting.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry, Barbara.
Okay, yeah. Well, should I address the questions to you individually and then... Okay, Barbara.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question because I think so. I mean, some of the surprising things that we learned in the book was that a lot of the behavior that, adolescent depression and anxiety, some of the risk-taking behavior, some of the sort of head-scratching, knuckle-headed things that adolescents do, which drives parents crazy, when you look across species and you begin to see that, well, wait a minute, very similar kinds of things are happening in similarly aged or developmentally staged animals, all of a sudden it becomes less about, well, what the parents did or didn't do and more about this really ancient biology of adolescence. So, for example, we know that adolescents are on social media a lot these days and, that it can really affect how they feel, right? So, I mean, if you've been around an eighth grader who's composing an Instagram post, and then you watch her check for likes, it looks like she thinks it's a matter of life and death. And, the truth is that an animal's status, an adolescent animal's status, that is where they rank relative to their peers, in the wild is a matter of life or death. And, you know, we humans are walking around with a lot of the physiology and brain biology of our animal ancestors. And so to some extent, you know, that adolescent girl who's wringing her hands over how many likes there are or whether her filter looks good, you know, as a parent, I might say, why do you care what those kids think? But that would not be particularly evolutionarily informed.
But what about even comparing us with other animals? I mean, with other humans. For example, I just learned that among hunter-gatherers, adolescent girls don't start menstruating until they're 16 or 17, a lot later than most do today.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because we know that there are some communities where puberty is happening much earlier, particularly for girls, but also for boys. And so that's interesting to kind of look at across species, but it turns out that there are even animals who are going through puberty earlier. So it's not that, you know, every species has a specific age where they go through puberty. The environment really impacts when that happens. And in a fascinating parallel, you know, we know that if kids have a higher body mass index, that is, if they're a little bit heavier, they're more likely to go through puberty earlier. And in one of the studies that we took a look at, ring-tailed lemur, you know, lemur are animals from Madagascar, but when they're living in other regions where they're getting more food and their body masses are a little higher, those females also are going through puberty earlier. So there's this fascinating species-wide connection around puberty.
Catherine, in your previous book, you coined the word zoobiquity. What do you mean for that to describe?
So it's we pronounce it zoobiquity.
Zoobiquity, thought of zoology, so...
Yes, of course. So zoobiquity combines the Greek word for animal with the Latin word for everywhere or everything, so ubiquity and zoo, and we came up with zoobiquity, which means the animal, seeing the overlap between animals and humans, and that's what the work that Barbara and I do together is we research, write, and teach about looking to the natural world for solutions to human problems, and zoobiquity was about more of the physical medical problems that we might have. We looked at cancer, heart disease, infectious disease, fainting, and various other sort of physical issues. But we also looked at psychiatric conditions that sometimes seem to be uniquely human or like a product of our big human brain and our amazing human culture, but are actually found across species. And those included eating disorders and self-injury and addiction. And that is what we're trying to do in wildhood, is to look to the natural world to find underlying evolutionary, ancient, historical connections between humans and other animals that go beyond culture, that go beyond gender, race, and the things that we use to differentiate ourselves as human beings, and find, again, these four universal tests that animals really need to learn in order to become mature, functioning, and we would even say healthy physically and happy mentally adults.
There's a section in Zoobiquity about the sexual education of foals, how stallions were raised, that seemed to make a lot of sense across species.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how the what we think of as being this unique human psychology isn't so unique. I mean, at a minimum, the origins of human psychology, you know, comes from our animal ancestors. But sexual behavior is a really a good example of that. So it's not just horses, but we looked at a wide range of mammals. And, you know, if early in life, when they are sexual beginners, if they have traumatic experiences, or so in some cases, if they have sex too early, or if their first sexual experiences are painful.
Or they're abused.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. That has, you know, lifelong impact on their sexual function. And you bring up stallions, but for animals who, like stallions, for example, who may be, you know, breeding actually, quote-unquote, for a living. In other words, they are being used in largely, you know, to produce new offspring. That's, you know, problem for the people who own the horses. But as a larger and, we think, more relevant issue to human life, it really shows how sensitive all of us are psychologically, you know, throughout life, but particularly around that early period of puberty and then early sexual activity.
Barbara, you're
one of the reviews we did of the literature was of animal first times, and that was a concept that we hadn't I hadn't really thought too much about before writing this book was that every sexual creature has a first time. And what we learned was that whether you're looking at moths or blue whales or fruit flies or, you know, you name it, a kangaroo, that first time is often filled with uncertainty, fumbling, mixed signals, and animals need to learn not only the mechanics of copulation itself, but all the many, many, many specific and careful behaviors that have evolved to lead animals to that moment of mating. And those are the courtship rituals that we've seen a thousand times on nature documentaries. And Barbara and I really took a look at those and realized that within those courtship displays that animals do are the roots of probably consent in human.
Barbara, you're a medical doctor, a cardiologist. How did you feel about exploring the world of animals to get useful information about people? Is it speciesism that explains our reluctance as humans to admit to the similarities?
Yeah, so Catherine and I started looking at this, really, it's been over a decade ago, and we started looking at what physicians could learn from veterinarians and then expanded it to wildlife biologists and then to evolutionary biologists. And, you know, it's not part of the tradition of human medicine to turn to the world of veterinary medicine. I mean, we recognize as physicians that there's a connection, you know, but it's not really part of the culture. And part of that, I think, is just due to tradition and history of how medical schools function. But part of it is what we call human exceptionalism, which is this idea that, you know, we are somehow, oh, gosh, better, more elevated.
Well, we talk.
What's that?
We talk. And
we talk.
And write books.
Yes, of course, animals have complex communication, but we don't know about books. But the point is that, you know, in human medicine, what we found, 10 years ago was that there was sort of a head-scratching when we would talk to physicians about the fact that animals, so many dogs get so many cancers, and that animals can develop different kinds of heart disease and all these so-called human disorders. But that as we encourage physicians, which we do through our conferences, our Zubiquity conferences around the world, to examine whether, in fact, things are so uniquely human, and as they begin to examine them, they become more open and more interested, and we see there's so many commonalities. So, yeah, I mean, although human exceptionalism or speciesism was something of a blindfold for human medicine for a really long time, fortunately, we think that's changing, and it's opening up this really exciting moment for collaboration and thinking of human being as a human animal.
You write that your quickest way to understand adolescence began on a California beach in 2010. Why were you there?
Catherine?
Oh, sure. So we were researching the behavior of California sea otters, and we were looking out over the ocean with a biologist who was our guide, and he said, that what you're looking at out there is called the Triangle of Death. And we said, oh, why is it called the Triangle of Death? And he said it's because it has more great white sharks than almost anywhere else in the world, and the shark attacks there are, it's a very high rate of them.
So why would animals enter the triangle? Is it out of naivete, or are they thrill-seekers?
What's interesting is that they don't. The animals have learned not to go into the Triangle of Death because it is so dangerous. All the animals, that is, except for one group, and those are adolescent sea otters. And they do go in there. And what we learned after doing the research on this kind of animal behavior is that they are entering there because they are inexperienced. They don't know what they're doing. But they also, because of neurobiological changes, which in humans we would call the teenage brain, they are more primed to seek novelty, to seek adventure, to take risks with their, again, what we would in humans call friends, but with their same age peers. And what we found by going to the Triangle of Death was a natural, wild example of adolescent risk-taking, and that's really what sparked our interest in this topic, was that if a wild animal could be taking a risk that we see in human teens, what can we learn from that behavior to tell us about this age, this time of life, that might be able to help keep our own human teens safer.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. And my guests are Barbara Nadison Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. Their book, Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. How does a scientist go about studying adolescents? How can you distinguish adolescents from other members of their group?
Well, that's a great question because, one of the challenges is looking at a group of animals who are, let's say, large physically and figuring out, well, what ages are there? So are they? So consider you're looking at a herd of zebra. Well, you can tell that the little ones are juveniles, not so hard. But then you look at the adults or so-called adults and you think, well, gosh, can I tell who's really old and who's really young? And that can be trickier. It's easier for us as humans to do with other groups of humans, but it can also be tricky. You can be walking through a mall and see a group of females walking past. You can be looking at them from behind, and they may be tall, and that you may think, oh, they're young women, they're 20s, but they turn around and, they have braces, even though they're 5'10", right? So it can be tricky. But we actually defined animal adolescence as the period that begins with puberty, and how puberty works is really very similar across at least vertebrates. In fact, we have a section called Jurassic Puberty about dinosaur puberty, which is really so similar to human puberty in many ways. But it begins in puberty, and it ends when a mature animal emerges. And in our species, we have people who start puberty, and by the criteria that we apply in Wildhood, those four tests never become truly mature adults. But in nature, in the wild, an animal that passes through puberty and doesn't really master those four tests is not going to survive into mature adulthood.
You say that adolescents share a horizontal identity.
This is a term that we borrowed from Andrew Solomon's Far From the Tree, which is a horizontal identity is one that you share with people who you aren't necessarily genetically or familially kin to. And we think that's actually a really important way of thinking about adolescence, is that in some ways, an adolescent, in high school or college or even early adulthood, has more in common with a fruit fly or a humpback whale or a wolf going through adolescence than they do with their younger sibling or with their parents in terms of the inexperience that they're facing and the things they need to accomplish during that age period. They have, they share this horizontal tribe with the worldwide group of adolescents.
How long have scientists been looking at human adolescents? What influence did Margaret Mead's coming of age in Samoa have on the way it's been studied?
Well, we really do think, Margaret Mead was the pioneer of using a comparative approach to look at the problems of modern adolescence. And, she was comparing different cultures. So, of course, she was a, most famous anthropologist, really, of the 20th century, rather. And when she herself was only 22 years old, she was an adolescent, really, she set sail to Samoa to study adolescence and was we do think that this comparative approach, is exciting. But what we decided to do was to, stand on the shoulders of the giantess that she was and look comparatively across species. So scientists, and actually scholars and philosophers have been looking at adolescence for a really long time. Aristotle writes about the challenges of adolescence. But in the last, several decades, there's been lots of interest in adolescence, and particularly the neurobiology, the teenage brain. But what we were really excited to do over the past 5 years is to challenge some of the assumptions about adolescence being uniquely human and really look broadly across species to identify whether the challenges are similar and, frankly, whether adolescence in nature maybe doing things better than we're doing it ourselves and learning from those adaptations in the wild.
Another key figure in this conversation.
By looking at behavior in across adolescent animals, and what we found was that adolescents tended to take more risks than their younger and older peers, and they tended to prefer the company of their same-age peers to adults and youngers, and they tended to practice courtship behaviors that in humans we would maybe say experiment sexually, and then they tended to leave home or leave their sort of natal birth area at a certain age. So those were the basis, those common behaviors were the basis of our finding these four core competencies of safety, status, sex, and self-reliance.
And some people even have viewed adolescence as a kind of a malady, a disease.
Yes, exactly right. Almost a disease to be cured or a stigma to be avoided. And
so what cures it? Finally becoming an adult? Or there are some people I know who never leave adolescence in some levels.
In a way, the only way out is through. And I mean, it's a paradox that in order to become experienced, you have to get experience. You have to put yourself out there and get it. And we did find that animals do need to learn how to keep themselves safe from predators and exploiters before they can become a mature adult. So, yeah.
You mentioned dinosaurs. What about tiktaalik fish? When did they live, and who unearthed their fossils?
Well, we teach undergraduates at Harvard and UCLA, and we teach in departments of evolutionary biology. And very often students have this idea that, you know, evolution is something you sort of see in the museum. You know, you see fossils, or, you know, you sort of think, well, these are all ancient, extinct species. And what we really are trying to do is to take that perspective, but to take the fossil and animate it, bring Tiktaalik, who is this iconic species that really is the transitional species between water-living animals and land-living animals. So Tiktaalik was a species that was identified by Anil Shubin and his group, and the fins were turning into legs. They were kind of lobes, so Tiktaalik is a famous species. Well, what we are saying is that, well, not only was Tiktaalik, you know, a quote-unquote species, Tiktaalik, the species, had lots of individuals, and each one of those individuals, if they became adults, went through puberty. And they were, during puberty, they had behavioral changes, like all animals who go through puberty, and they had to gain experience. They had to keep themselves safe. They had to learn how to socialize. They needed to learn courtship. They needed to learn sexual communication if they were going to breed and reproduce. And finally, Tiktaalik needed to learn how to feed her or himself. So what we're trying to do is to say, yes, these, you know, whether it's a dinosaur that you're looking at a museum or the fossil of a mastodon somewhere, each one of those animals, if they're going to be an adult, they went through puberty, they went through adolescence, they went through what we call wildhood, which is the universal experience of becoming an adult across the animal kingdom.
And why do you think that the Tiktaalik adolescents were leading the exodus to land?
Well, one reason is that just by their very age, adolescents tend to be subordinate. They tend to be on the lower end of the social hierarchy. And so often they are pushed out of their home territories and need to find new territory. So one reason for that might have been that they were being pushed out of their territories by the older individuals in their groups, and so they ended up on land because the sea was taken. Another possibility is that with these neurobiological changes that do make them more prone to embrace novelty and seek new things, they might have just been sort of like naturally adventurous, the way many of our human adolescents are. They also might have been trying to escape predators and finding ways of hiding from predators, and that might have also put them in a position where they found safety on land and then realized that they were actually able to survive there. We ran this idea by Neil Shubin, who was the leader of the team that discovered Tiktaalik, and he said that was quite possible, and that they actually hadn't studied specific kind of age and development of those fossils, but they did find them in many different sizes, which meant something kind of as profound as it is simple, which is that Tiktaalik did grow up, so there was an adolescent phase that Tiktaalik would have had.
And there aren't Tiktaaliks anymore, but are there similar, do they have descendants the way birds are descendants of the dinosaurs?
Oh, absolutely. All land living animals, including ourselves, are descendants of Tiktaalik. And the kind of the takeaway, I mean, we also share, you know, when we're adolescents, I mean, not only is the neurobiology of adolescence, does it contribute to some of the risk-taking and injuries that we see in accidents and sometimes tragedies that we see in human adolescents, but that neurobiology is also responsible for innovation and creativity. And, you know, those first Tiktaalik, if they were in fact adolescents, that would have been an incredible innovation. I mean, Darwin himself was an adolescent at 22 when he stepped on the beagle to go on his, you know, famous journey. And mathematicians and inventors and writers and artists, many of the great leaders, intellectual leaders in human history, have done their greatest and most important work when they were adolescents, when they had adolescent brains. So the adolescent brain isn't just a problem, it's an opportunity. And one of the things that we like to do is to put that lens on and look across nature for examples so that we don't have to pathologize it so much.
You've described a number of people in their 20s as adolescents. When does adolescence end then? I always thought adolescence ended somewhere around the time that you were allowed to vote.
Yeah, one of the challenges is there's so many definitions.
Or go to war.
Right. I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics has one definition. The CDC has another. As you said, you can vote at one age. You can drink at a different age. You can see an R-rated movie at one age. And the neurobiologists are now telling us that adolescence ends when the brain stops developing, which can be as late as the late 20s, some even say the early 30s. So, boy, it's a big, confusing mess. And so what we really tried to do with Wildhood was to redefine the period of adolescence, not using some number, some specific chronological point, but rather fulfilling these tests, achieving these competencies. An animal is a mature adult when it can, number one, keep itself safe, number two, understand how to socialize and find a place for itself in a group, number three, really effectively communicate sexually, understand and express, and then finally, find its own food, find its own shelter, really be self-reliant so that it can be a leader for the next generation. That's the end of adolescence, and that's the end of what we call Wildhood.
And the first section of the book deals with the concept of safety. Are adolescents more vulnerable and less safe than infants?
Well, the demographics of adolescents, I mean, infants are at high risk of a number of things. There are medical issues, of course, early mortality around birth, perinatal mortality, and then accidents and all kinds of unfortunate things can befall infants. But if you look at the post-infant phase, if you look at childhood through the 30s, ages 16 to 19 are very high risk for accidents, for accidental injury and death. And part of that, in fact, is this unique physiology, the uniqueness of the adolescent brain, which, you know, compels animals to leave their burrows and nests, but also subjects them to risk. But the flip side of that is that not all of what endangers adolescents, and that brain biology that pushes animals out of safety, out of parental protection, and into independence. There are things that wild animal adolescents do to keep themselves safer, which we can learn from, and one of them is predator inspection, which is what those adolescent sea otter were doing. So what you see adolescent gazelle doing is to approach cheetah sometimes. I mean, instead of running away from one of their primary predators, they will sometimes, along with other adolescent cheetahs, so there's safety in numbers, they actually approach and inspect the cheetahs. Meerkat do the same thing. I mean, bats do the same thing. So adolescents sometimes, when they're adolescent animals sometimes approach their predators to learn about the most dangerous things in their lives, and that helps keep them safer.
Did you find a difference between male and female adolescents in terms of risk-taking?
We don't know. We can't conclusively say that because most of the animal studies are not First of all, many of them don't even differentiate the age of the animals, but when they do, it's infrequent that they identify who the males and females are. But it's a question that we have, and we hope to know in the future.
And you wanted to add something there, Catherine?
I was just going to say that one thing that we learned was that every animal that's leaving parental protection for the first time is predator naive. That's the term that animal behaviorists use to describe that phase of life. And so what these young animals have to do is become predator experienced. They have to go from predator naive to predator aware to predator experienced. And it's all made even more difficult by the fact that they are literally easy prey because they are out in the world without protection, without experience. And we found many examples of predators that specifically target adolescent prey because they're easier to catch.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Just a bit of the toy symphony played by young adolescents. One big difference, I guess, is musical competence. As we get older, we hope we play a little better than that. My guests are Barbara Nadison Horowitz and Catherine Barras. Their book, Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals, published by Scribner. Your first story is about a king penguin you call Ursula. Did you name her?
We didn't name her, but I just have to respond to that music that you just played with a couple of clunkers. Because, humpback whales are singers, right? The males court the females with these beautiful, loud choruses that the notes, travel across the oceans to reach the females. But the adolescent male humpbacks are the ones who are making the clunkers. And the scientists who study humpback whale song have recorded these songs and have heard individuals who, it doesn't sound quite right. They're not holding the notes long enough, or they're just off somehow. And they believe that those kind of not so good singers are actually the adolescent males. So,
and they need to practice. practice. It's a good thing you can tell your own kid when they're not wanting to practice their instrument.
Now, getting back to the king penguins, although we're talking about a female, why that species and this particular animal? What methods did you use to collect the data, and how did you monitor her?
Right. So Ursula is the name that a group of wildlife biologists, penguinologists who study king penguins, that was a name that they gave her along with several other penguins that they were studying. And what we were looking for
isn't that sexist? Shouldn't she have been a queen penguin?
I'm going to take a
royal penguin.
It's true.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But what we were looking for, we wanted to tell the stories of actual wild animal adolescents, specifically individuals, as a way of illustrating how those animals did or didn't face the test, those four tests. And for the safety test, we chose the king penguin. And penguins, as you probably know, they typically hatch and they're taken care of by parents for a period of time. And then they have to dive into the icy waters around, Antarctica often, and make it on their own. They have to hunt and they have to survive.
And you say their first day is literally sink or swim.
It's dangerous. It's very dangerous, that first experience of diving in the water, because as Catherine said, they're absolutely predator naive. They don't know yet what they will know in a year or 5 years or 10 years. And interestingly, their survival rate is very low that first year. In some instances, 7 out of 10 don't make it back. But every year that they survive, they're more likely to survive the next year, and so on and so forth. They learn to recognize probably where the orcas and leopard seals are hanging out. They learn to time their dives. They probably understand whether to swim higher or lower. They pick up all the micro experiences that all of us have to get to be safer. I mean, think about when you when you're first driving, and then when you're a 20-year veteran driver, all the little things that you know that you don't know that first day, week, month, year. And that's what we saw with Ursula. Now, Ursula made it through the phase of the study that that she was tracked on. I mean, she made it through the most dangerous area right off the coast of South George Island, where a lot of the predators are just waiting for those penguins.
So she had to go from being predator naive to predator aware.
She did. She did.
Yes.
Every penguin has to.
Every penguin, every adolescent has to do that. But you're right. One of the reasons why we chose Ursula and the story of the penguin is that their experience with that is so dramatic because it happens in a single day, in a single moment, really. If you think about that process for something like a, maybe a wolf or a gazelle, it's a little bit more structured. It's not in that exact moment when they dive into the water.
What does the term Zugenruhe mean? I hope I pronounced it correctly.
Well, Zugenruhe is a German word for, it describes the period right before migration or dispersal. That is when an animal leaves home and goes off. And it's used often to describe this behavior in birds before they take off from the nest, where they are sleepless, they're restless, they've got more activity. When we think about it, we've talked about this a lot, sort of that night before something exciting happening, where you that feeling where you can't sleep. But Zugenruhe really shows you that the brain is preparing the animal for what's going to happen next. And it's fascinating to learn across different animals how bodies actually are changing in anticipation of leaving home. Including eating more, including changes in immune function. So the leaving home and making it on your own, it's pretty ancient, and you know, bodies have evolved to prepare for that.
Isn't there something more voluntary about the kind of risk that human adolescents expose themselves to as compared with penguins? After all, penguins have to dive and swim to survive. Is there any rational reason for a 16-year-old to pretend he or she is 21 so that they can get a drink?
Well, there is. We think that there is. I mean, it's what we're doing is we're saying, look, what can we learn from studying wild animal adolescents that we can't know if we're just looking at our own species? And predator inspection is one of those takeaways. So the fact that we see this behavior of adolescents going into dangerous situations voluntarily, whatever that means, in a gazelle or a bat or a meerkat, suggests that there is a benefit to learning about things that are most likely to harm you in the future. And I'm not saying it's safe for a human adolescent to go into a dangerous environment, but rather that there is at least probably a neurobiology that's luring them into those situations or pushing them into those situations. And possibly, if we look in the right way, there are benefits to human adolescents from learning about danger in a controlled way, maybe with peers, so that when they encounter it later, when they're adults, perhaps on their own, they have more of a chance of surviving.
Well, we can warn them about dangers, but some become susceptible to Jeffrey Epstein's and others don't. I'm sorry I brought that up. It's not in your book.
No. I mean, it's actually...
No, I mean, it's interesting to ponder that, right? To see what the... why that happens. I mean, probably there are predator-inspecting gazelles that end up more or less in danger from these cheetahs that are about to attack them as well. But there are other things that play into that, such as the childhood they might have had, these younger animals, and then also just the fact that many times, as we were talking earlier, adolescents are easy prey, and so they don't have the experience to defend themselves. And we even learned about a term called ephebophobia, which is the fear or the hatred even of adolescence. And it is the special kind of exploitation that older animals, it's used in a human context, but we found examples of it across the animal kingdom, that older animals use their advantages to exploit younger animals. And I think that the Jeffrey Epsteins of the world definitely did prey on adolescents. They were not going after older animals.
And you point out that adolescents are targeted by the financial industry as well, another form of ephebophobia.
Yeah, exactly right. Go ahead, Barbara.
It's part of that same idea that if an adolescent is a subordinate, and that's a term that we're using because all animals live in these hierarchies, right? And older animals tend to be the dominants, and younger animals, particularly adolescents, tend to be subordinate. And so, subordinates are exploited across the animal kingdom. And, if a younger animal doesn't have social support, doesn't have, the protection of either a family or recourse, well, they're a perfect target for whether it's a financial organization or other kinds of exploitation, and we do see, unfortunately, as you're alluding to with the Epstein question, lots of exploitation of adolescents. And just to add something, sexual coercion does occur in the animal kingdom. That's been known for some time. And one of the really interesting things that we learned in researching this book is that younger females particularly are, although sometimes there are some examples of males, are more likely to be exploited. The examples we found were in younger females who lacked social support and lacked sort of probably the proper dominance behaviors to keep themselves safe.
In mammals or across all of the animal kingdom?
Well, we found examples of sexual coercion across the animal kingdom to talk about vertebrates from, fish through other mammals, including birds. Of course, this has been, well known for some time. It's in the peer-reviewed literature. We also actually look at the origin of consent. There's been a fair amount of research looking at sexual coercion, but we're really interested in changing that lens and looking for examples of restraint and what we call the neurobiology of no. So, there's examples of both, and of course, finding behavior in the wild is no endorsement or justification for it in human life, but it's worth noting. But our particular interest was whether developmentally adolescent animals were at some uniquely increased risk, and we found out that in fact, they probably are.
My guests on London Lopate at Large are Barbara Nadison Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, whose latest book is Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. There are a number of other terms that we should probably go through because they are all relevant. Startle response, defense mechanisms. I have a whole bunch of them from your book. Mm-hmm. Island tameness. Where should we start?
We love these terms that come from the animal behavior literature that we think apply really, in some cases lyrically and in some cases poignantly to the human condition. So just to go with island tameness, that is the tendency for animals whose predators have disappeared to become less vigilant and less able to deal with real dangers in their world. So
what Darwin described when he went to the Galapagos.
Exactly right. So it can happen on a literal island if the predators die out or just don't make it to that island that the animals happen to be on. But it can also happen in valleys, like in Yellowstone. It happened when wolves were taken out of that ecosystem, and it was discovered. Island tameness was discovered when the wolves were reintroduced, and the animals had to get used to being preyed upon once the wolves were back. And we think it's really interesting to apply that to both sort of social culture and physical safety in human beings, the idea of what happens when we get used to situations where we're not at risk and then the risk returns. Mm.
In terms of defense mechanisms, what kind of defense mechanisms do red-eyed tree frogs have?
Right, so animals have evolved lots of strategies to keep themselves safe, right? So some of what keeps animals safe in the wild is inborn, right? So they don't have to do any learning to have it, and some of it they learn from parents, and some of what keeps animals safe they have to learn on their own. But it turns out these red-eyed tree frogs are an example of inborn safety, a defense mechanism or a mechanism of defense. And these frogs are gestating. The eggs are deposited on these leaves, and they're growing and they're developing. But if before full gestation is completed, they sense that there's a snake nearby, that there's a predator, they can feel the vibration, they speed hatch. They basically deliver themselves, in essence, prematurely. That is, they develop, they hatch, and they drop down into the water. Now, they are not as developed as they would be if they had been able to complete the gestation, but it does keep them alive. So it is an inborn example of a mechanism of defense.
What was discovered about the preferred prey of owls from examining regurgitated pellets in South America?
That was an example of...
And how does that apply to my life?
That was an example of the easy prey. So we have several examples, just it was one after the next once we started looking for it, of predatory animals that preferentially seek out adolescent prey. So we found these owls that preferentially preyed on adolescent tucutuco, which are a kind of South American rodent. We found a kind of orca called a Biggs whale that preferentially preys on humpback adolescents and, doesn't bother with the calves because they're under protection of their moms and any male escorts that are around, and they don't go after the mature ones. They go after those inexperienced adolescents.
Who are seen as easy prey?
They are easy prey.
We even found adolescent penguins that prey on adolescent sardines.
Adolescent sardines. How would you know?
Well, that's kind of the point of the book, is that they give themselves away by certain behaviors. So they are, they don't quite know how to keep themselves safe. They don't. They haven't yet figured out social hierarchies to have allies around. They are immature and fumbling and a little bit inexperienced sexually, and they don't know quite how to get their own food and live in the world on their own.
Getting back to island tameness, Yellowstone elk are a classic example of island tameness. After the wolves returned, did they have to learn to be aware? Did they have to it's not genetic, the fear of the predator?
So some of it, right, so some anti-predation behavior is inborn and probably retained, even if the animals haven't experienced it in quite a while. But it can be pretty significantly unlearned. And but fortunately, fortunately in the sense that, there is some anti-predation behavior is pretty broadly retained by animals. Applying it to our lives and is sort of exciting. Kath and I started wondering, well, how does island tameness manifest itself, or does it, even in modern human life? So we're being a little bit metaphorical here, but it's think about how people make investment decisions, and think about if we have a period of time when there hasn't been a big financial, crash, if the stock market has been, doing well and things are kind of pretty stable, people tend to become less fearful about the investments that they make, take certain chances, and then there's a big crash, and all of a sudden there's a kind of re-recognition of that danger. And if you think of that as a kind of example of how island tameness operates, it's kind of an interesting frame for looking at a wide range of human experiences.
Whether that's vaccination rates or political regimes or even physical dangers that get reintroduced into an environment.
What did a 10-year study by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children discover from looking at incidents of attempted abductions?
Yeah, we were really interested what we could learn from how adolescent animals learn about predators, whether we could take that information and find ways to keep human adolescents and even kids safe from human predators, and, you know, particularly sexual predators. And, you know, we learn lots of interesting things. One point is that, you know, in different ages, adolescents are, children and adolescents are at risk in different ways. But one really helpful strategy that, you know, is recommended is someone, if a kid is being attacked, is to call for help. That, you know, finding help is important. Alarm calling is what it's called in nature. And, you know, predators come to learn about what works and what doesn't work. And if alarm calling by a potential target results in help arriving and that predator losing their prey, then they want to avoid that. So just to go back to those big orcas, it's a grisly but interesting detail that when they attack those adolescent humpbacks, they, again, it is grisly, but they rip out their tongues and throats. Mm. And that may be because their ability to alarm call is therefore removed. But to circle back to the human case, it is really interesting to consider whether the strategies that are used, that have evolved in animal adolescents to keep themselves safe from predators, can be actually taken and used in human life.
There are signals of unprofitability, you say. And how is that strategy similar to what psychologist Lawrence Steinberg advises to human adolescents who are trying to deal with bullies?
Signals of unprofitability are behaviors that animals do to signal to a predator, to let the predator know that they are going to be a major pain to catch and kill. So basically, predators have to do a cost-benefit analysis every time they set out to make a kill, and they look at a group of animals, and they find the one that's going to take the least amount of effort to catch, but at the same time give them the most benefit nutritionally. And so if an animal can signal to that predator that it is going to put up a fight, that it's going to that it has so much energy that it's going to be able to outrun it, that it that it's going to, be able to summon allies to fight off the predator, then that predator is going to probably move on to a different target. And that was something that Steinberg, who, you know, I'm sure you know, is one of the leaders in adolescent behavior in humans, in studying that, he suggests, if you can, if you're approached by a bully, to sort of like look them in the eye and make sure that they know that you know that they're there, and that can sometimes be enough to make them choose a different target or move on from you.
What's the oddity effect? Are predators attracted to the animals, the adolescents that don't seem to be fitting in?
There's a tendency.
Bullies sure do.
Exactly, and there's a tendency, if you look at think of a school of fish, they all usually, not always, but they usually are similarly sized and colored. They look the same, and they tend to swim the same. Their fin beat, their tail beat frequency is the same, and that's not accidental. It turns out that fish like to swim with fish that look like them because predators typically target on different, that is, odd-shaped fish. Let's use that example. And not only does that odd-shaped fish have a higher chance of being preyed upon, the entire group that is swimming with that odd-shaped fish has a higher rate of predation. So as a consequence, the conformity effect leads to flocks of birds and schools of fish kind of looking the same, and odd-looking individuals are cast out of those groups.
We have very little time left, unfortunately. Time goes so fast when we're talking about these kinds of things, so I can't get to helicopter parenting and what you write about Western bluebirds. But just one more thing. Are farm-raised fish more vulnerable to predators than wild fish? Didn't some Scandinavian scientists experiment to see if they could be trained to be to do better against predators?
This was such an interesting study, yes. They, you know, salmon is a huge industry in Scandinavia, and so for the farm salmon, they were discovering that when they would take the young fish, raise them in tanks, and then put them back into their rivers so that they could grow up and then be, caught, that predators were waiting for these predator-naive young adolescent fish to come out every time they were released because they were so easy to catch. And so what these fish farmers wanted to do was see if they could train them to have experience with predators before they were released into the river, and that might help keep them safe. And they did find that fish that were given the chance to see, smell, experience what a predatory cod looked and smelled and sounded like under the water did do better as they made this journey down the river during their adolescence. And the ones that were just kept in happy innocence without having any idea of what the predator might be or look like or sound like, they got eaten at higher rates. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that was interesting was that fish that were allowed to learn these defensive behaviors with their peers learned how to school faster, they learned how to respond better, and we use that to look at peer pressure in human populations and to see that it's not always bad, that a lot of times these lessons are learned better when you learn them with your friends.
Barbara Nadison Horowitz and Catherine Barris have been my guests on today's Leonard Lopate at Large, talking about their fascinating book, Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals, published by Scribner. It's been a real pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you so much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Fran Higgins, who produced this segment. If you're new to the program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter and our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. As we said earlier, our pledge line is active once again, so why not show your support for Leonard Lopate at Large by making a donation of any amount right now by calling 516-620-3602 or by going to the website WBAI.org and following the instructions. In the past, we've told you about all the expenses we have at the station, like our antenna, phones, equipment, and of course, rent. But ever since WBAI was knocked off the air for a month by a rogue faction at the Pacifica Foundation, our need has been even greater. We need your help just to get our facilities back to the level that they were before our station was taken over. I'm happy to report that we're finally broadcasting from our new studio, which has been in construction for the better part of the last year. But that means we still have expenses, and we have to continue working on that studio. And we need our listeners to step up and show their support to keep the quality of Leonard Lopate at Large up to the standard that you've come to expect and to make sure that this show is never interrupted again. The best way to do that is to make a contribution of any amount that you can. And if you can see your way to becoming a BAI buddy by making a sustaining monthly donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, you can do that by going to our website, WBAI.org, or by calling 516-620-3602. Every amount helps, whether you're becoming a sustaining member or making a one-time contribution. The important thing is to step up and give. And thank you from all of us here at Leonard Lopate at Large for your generous support.